Hi, I'm Natalie Dale, and you have found your way back to Ahead of the Curve. We are a podcast by the Georgia Department of Transportation that focuses on the people, programs, and projects that keep Georgia DOT ahead of the curve. Today, we're going to talk about one such project, a unique conservation effort on our right-of-way, one of the largest public spaces that you and I experience every day. What's going on there? We're about to find out.
...94% of Americans acknowledge that text messaging while driving is dangerous, and yet many people still do it. In fact, text messaging is considered the most dangerous type of distracted driving. Any kind of distracted driving endangers the driver and also their passengers, pedestrians, and others using the road. The hands-free Georgia law prohibits drivers from writing or sending texts, reading messages, posting on social media, and other forms of mobile device usage while driving. Let's end this dangerous habit before it ends you and others. Know the rules of the road to keep yourself and other drivers safe. Learn more at gahighwaysafety.org. Remember, don't reply. Stay alive.
Welcome back to Ahead of the Curve. Again, as promised, we're going to talk about one of my favorite beautiful creatures, butterflies. Gorgeous, beautiful creatures that, whether you realize it or not, have become a vital part of our infrastructure for many reasons. We're going to start today with an old friend, not necessarily of the program, but of the comms department, Felicity. Felicity Davis is the landscape architect manager for Georgia DOT. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We should have had you by now, honestly, because your job with the department does so much. No day's the same for you?
Absolutely not. It's always something different.
Okay, so give us a little bit of a view of what a typical or not typical day for you looks like.
I can start with looking at our wildflower maps to think about planning our next planting season. And then I may get a call about a tree concern in a specific district and have to find information for someone there. I may have to go out to a job site and look at vegetation on a job site. It just really varies.
Where did your passion for this come from? Is it a childhood thing? Was it something that's always in you, or did you just sort of find your way into your role?
I've always loved vegetation and the landscape, and I started gardening when I was a teenager, and I've just always gardened, and I've loved flowers, and I studied horticulture in school, and then I found out about landscape architecture, and that combined art and architecture and plants all into one thing. And I've worked in engineering and design side of things. And Georgia DOT has been the first time I've worked in a maintenance department as a landscape architect. And it's just really, you learn something every day and you see so many beautiful plants that are native to our state on the rights of way. It's just kind of a sweet spot for all of those factors coming together.
Well, I have a high respect for you and for your position, because I am one of those people who really enjoys the beauty of it, and I am very bad at it. I keep nothing. I just bought a Venus flytrap, and we're going to see how that goes. I hear they're a little complex, so that was probably not the plant for me. However, no plant seems to be the plant for me, but I do enjoy all of the thought and the process that goes into it and the beauty behind it. So thank you for what you do, because I can do communications very well. I can grow nothing. But that might be a different conversation for a different day.
Well, I got to say, the more you learn about plants and growing plants, the more you realize you just never really know, because I really do believe there are certain plants that like certain people and that they can grow. And then there are certain plants that just don't want to grow for certain people.
And certain plants that are native to Georgia.
It's something
I've really learned a lot about with our pollinator gardens and with, you know, the work that we do around Georgia. There is such a focus on making sure that what we are doing reflects Georgia, what is native to Georgia, what will build and grow, not just these beautiful areas, but what supports things like pollinators in Georgia. So talk a little bit about how we make decisions about what we're putting on our roadways.
Well, the first thing that we always consider is it something that's going to be able to grow on the right-of-way? The right-of-way is a very challenging environment. It can be very hot. It can be very dry. We're very lucky in the state of Georgia and in the Southeast generally that we have so many incredible and beautiful plants that will thrive in that kind of an environment. So you have to think, first of all, what is going to grow there? And then you want to think about what can grow sustainably in that area. What's going to come back every year? What's going to be reliable every year? Then you also have to think about what's the use of that area. Do the plants need to be lower for people to be able to see? Can they grow taller? So there's a lot of factors like that that go into choosing. And we do have some pretty reliable and wonderful native plant species that we used to grow on the right of way for wildflowers and to support pollinator insects.
Part of what we're going to talk about today, which I'm going to jump forward because I want us to meet our next guest. We're going to jump forward to jump back, which is, I think, how our brains are going to work here, which is great. So everyone's on the same page. I want to introduce Josh Weaver with The Ray. And The Ray has been a longtime friend and partner of the department. So Josh, welcome.
Thank you.
We've talked to The Ray, but not to you, so that's exciting.
Yeah.
Josh, we're really glad you're here today. Let's just start off by reminding our listeners about the purpose of The Ray, sort of your elevator speech for The Ray, because we've done deep dives into The Ray, and I just want to remind our listeners how invaluable and important and unique The Ray is to Georgia.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here. And actually, the highlight of my day was the traffic getting here. So
we have nothing to do with that. Different department.
So The Ray is a nonprofit organization. We're in our 10th or 11th year now. And we work with organizations and transportation agencies trying to make the transportation sector safer, the roadways safer. So kind of how we got started was Racy Anderson, had Interface Company, founded Interface. He wanted his company to become carbon neutral. Interface makes carpet tiles. He passed away in 2011. And then his daughters were like, how can we continue his legacy? And approached Governor Deal in 2014 and had a portion of Interstate 185 from the Georgia-Alabama line to LaGrange named the Ray Highway. And from there, then the Ray started working with GDOT. And, next thing you know, there's charging stations at the visitor center. There's FeNode soil sensors installed at the visitor center. There's pollinator meadows installed, in the right of way. And then at exit 6 and exit 14 and various other things going on there. So that was kind of like the lab, if you will. Right. And then it's just grown from there. I mean, we work with, I believe it's up to like 28 DOTs across the country in various ways. We do a lot of other stuff, with GDOT, that's not in the aforementioned things there. And then we also work with corporations that are tied to the transportation sector, right? So like with pollinator meadows and various other things like that.
Where did your passion for this come from?
Yeah, so it was interesting when Felicity was saying that, my passion, it would probably steer some people away from it. But, I have those vivid memories, right? Like one of them was my uncle was a teacher, and so I would hang out at their house in the summers. They lived very close to me, and he was big into plants. He always loved like Augusta National Golf Club and loved azaleas. So I remember one summer, me and my cousin were in there playing like Sega. This was like early 90s, and and he's like, "Y'all get outside. We got to plant some plants today." So we get in his truck and we go to Kmart. Kmart had like 1 gallon azaleas on sale for like 79 cents, and he got like 300 of them. And we're out there in the middle of July planting these things. And you would think that would run most people away from it. I was like,
you loved it. You're like, give me more.
I was like, this is awesome. And then you get to see 10 or 15 years from there, you go back and see what those plants become and how they have tied into the landscape. And then some other vivid memories. I was getting checked out of school my 8th grade year with my granddad. He found fruit trees on sale at Lowe's or Walmart. And he was like, "I'm checking you out of school to go help me plant fruit trees at the house." Right. So, of course, getting checked out is awesome. But then you got to go dig a 2-foot hole for a pear tree. It's like, but no, I loved it. And so then when I was graduating high school, Columbus Tech at the time, I'm from Columbus, they had a 2-year horticulture program. And I enrolled in that and started working in landscaping and just kind of thought that was going to be my path. And then in 2011, actually got hired with the Georgia Department of Agriculture and started being a regulatory person, right? I was working with growers and farmers and golf courses and stuff like that, and with seed, feed, and fertilizer. So I saw this whole other side of the industry, like how we get the products on the end user side. I saw how those are regulated. And then from there, I went to Clemson and worked there, Clemson Department of Pesticide Regulation, doing that same type of work. And while I was there, I was like, you know, I want to do more, but I was kind of always held back by my education, right? And so then I finished my bachelor's, and then I got my master's in soil science while I was at Clemson, and then got a PhD in plant environmental sciences with a specialty in turf and biostimulants and how they affect plant growth. And that's kind of what brought me to where I'm at now. I left Clemson in 2020 and got hired at Auburn, was teaching there during COVID. That was an interesting experience. teaching during COVID was very interesting. And teaching was never the reason why I got a PhD. I got a PhD to really do research and help teach and move things forward. And that's kind of what led me to the Ray. There was a project down on Exit 14, slope stabilization project in, I think, latter part of 21, through mutual people I know and the Ray knew. They were like, hey, you need to talk to this guy. He's doing this biostimulant research. So they came to me. I met with them. And next thing you know, April of 22, I'm out there putting jute mat and seeds on a slope. Didn't think it was going to lead to anything. You know, I would go by every now and then. It's growing good. It looks great. And then in September of 23, I checked my email, and I had an email from the executive director of the Ray, Allie Kelly. And it just simply had a job description in the email. And when you're in faculty, you always get these from companies. They're like, hey, if you have a student, can you pass it along to them? Maybe, you know. So I called her and I was like, this role is more than one of my 18 to 22 year old students. And so we talked through, and she's like, and after a few minutes, I was like, are you asking me if I'm interested in it? And she's like, yeah, I am. I was like, good, because I am.
Because yeah, we're there.
Yeah. And because I didn't want to teach, and I wanted to be able to do more. And if you would have told me in October of 23, when I left Auburn and came to the Ray, that we would be sitting here in August of 26 and have done the projects we're doing and the projects we're wanting to do with a partner like GDOT, I would have been like, there's no way like that we would have done that. Just out of that one slope and just those few pilot plots that the Ray had been involved in. Because when I came to the Ray, literally they were like, hey, you got the landscape lab, and it was the Ray Highway. And now we've got slopes that we've done over I-16 and up here in Atlanta. And I mean, so it's just, it's a pinch me moment. So I'm doing what that 12-year-old, when he's planting those azaleas, I never thought it would get this far, but I'm still having fun like I was 12 and I'm 42.
and I think the smaller things that I heard out of that maybe people didn't catch on to was that you're very smart because you taught at Auburn, which everyone knows I feel very passionately about my alma mater. But also Sega, a fabulous gaming system. If you get your kids off the screen, they're going to find their passion. They're going to find their career, because I heard I had to put the Sega down and my career was born.
Yes.
So that's a good reminder to me with my kids. So very smart. There's actually a third guest on this show. Y'all don't know. They're very quiet. They are the monarch butterfly. We're going to speak for them. I'm not going to speak for them. Y'all are. So sort of rounding the bases back to where we started, which is to talk about this partnership and this program. It's a lot of words, so y'all have to get me there. It's the Candidate Conservation Agreement with Assurances, and we're going to call that CCAA from now on because that's going to be easier, and it's going to cut the podcast from about an hour to probably back to 30 minutes if we just get it there. But the importance of the protection of pollinators, monarch butterflies, and the program that y'all are working together to sort of find innovative solutions for that. Felicity, take us to the basics, which is, let's start with who is the monarch butterfly and why we do this.
So the monarch butterfly is a really beautiful and unique species of butterfly that's it exists in other places in the world, but in North America and South America and, well, North America and Central America, it's a unique species in that it migrates. And it is a tiny little insect that migrates thousands and thousands and thousands of miles from the northern parts of North America, both down through the middle of the country, on the West Coast and the East Coast, all the way down to one particular mountain range in Mexico, where it hibernates over the winter and then migrates all the way back.
I'm going to nerd out on that. How long does that take?
Like
a typical migratory pattern.
I'm not a monarch expert, for sure. It takes a couple of months each way, but it is surprisingly quick because, as I understand with the monarch butterflies, is in the fall, they have one generation that comes down and goes over to Mexico and overwinters. And then they fly back over the Gulf of Mexico and on the eastern side, and then they lay eggs and new ones are born. Those go the next leg, then they lay eggs, and then that next generation's born, and they kind of leapfrog that way.
That's fascinating.
So one generation does this whole massive, really long migration, but then the generation in the spring sort of they grow and migrate, and then they lay their eggs, and they kind of, it's not the same generation
nature
going back
is,
up.
It gives me goosebumps. Nature is just too cool for us.
And this is all information that has kind of come out as people have been studying them since, you know, in North America. But they're, you know, everyone knows what a monarch butterfly looks like, even if you don't think you know. They're that orange and black striped butterfly that is just so iconic, and that you see pictures of it everywhere. And probably if you're thinking of a butterfly, that's probably the one that you're thinking about.
And they've been proposed for the endangered species list because they are, explain that.
Yes. So the populations of the monarch butterfly, the way that they count them is they're in Mexico where they migrate. They look and see how many acres do these monarch butterflies cover, because what they do is they go to these mountain areas and they all crowd around on pine trees. I think they're pine trees that they sit on, and they're just covering these pine trees, and they're just kind of sitting together and huddling together for warmth on these pine trees. And they look and see how many, I think they do it in hectares, not acres, but they see how much area do they cover. And they've been noticing, as they've been doing that over the past decades, that the number of the area that they're covering is less and less and less over time. Sometimes it goes up a little bit, sometimes it goes down a little bit, but the trend has been down and down and down. And they're such a unique and beautiful species that, you know, people want to save them. They're very, very interesting. They're very beautiful. They have a lot of strong cultural background. I was actually listening to a podcast one time that talked about that in Mexico, where they've got a lot of deep cultural associations as well. So they're such a unique and beautiful creature that we want to preserve them.
As far as being, a really important sort of player in these pollinator gardens and in pollinator areas, what happens? What is the downfall if populations continue to decline?
Well, I would say monarchs are one of those things that's known as an indicator species. If their populations are declining, it means that the populations of all other pollinator insects are declining as well. And this is something that has also been noticed in other insect populations. I'm sure you've probably heard of the whole idea that you used to drive down the road and you've got bugs all over your windshield, and now nobody has that problem anymore. That's because so many insect populations are shrinking so much because they don't have the habitat. Well, when you don't have that habitat for those insects, the plants that rely on them for pollination are not able to be pollinated. So you see fewer of those plants. You see fewer birds because those insects aren't there to feed the baby birds when they're growing. So it has a whole effect through the whole ecosystem. And the monarchs are an indicator of that. They're an important signal to say, this is going down, all of these insects are going down, and if we can keep those monarch populations healthy and strong, it means we're keeping everything else healthy and strong, and we're going to be able to have beautiful birds, beautiful plants, necessary plants, The plants that we grow for agriculture, for food and fiber and all of the other things that we use plants for. So they help show and supporting monarchs helps support all of these other things that are very important for our individual lives and for our economy and industries.
And as a transportation agency, we felt it necessary, vital, really, in 2021 to sign on to this CCAA, which is really a conservation effort by a lot of DOTs and a lot of private companies. But we were one of the first DOTs. So what does the whole agreement sort of outline?
What the Candidate Conservation Agreement is, GDOT is agreeing with U.S. Fish and Wildlife that we're going to do certain things that are known to help the populations of the monarch butterfly. And what that's going to do for GDOT is not only will we help preserve this beautiful and unique species and all of these other species that support our industry, our agriculture, our economy, and our environment, we will also, if the monarch butterfly is listed as endangered, it will help us to not have to do a lot of extra things. We'll be doing what we ought to be doing already. We'll already have it integrated into all of our vegetation management activities, and we won't have a big bump of having to do a lot of extra or individual or additional things in our maintenance activities.
Reduces the regulatory burden.
Exactly. That's a complicated way of saying reduces the regulatory burden. And also we get a lot of, you know, we get a lot of beauty and variety out of it as well.
Josh, the Ray and GDOT do a lot of things together.
Yes.
From your perspective, how are y'all involved with the conservation of the monarch butterfly? Where have we sort of met in the middle to do sometimes what GDOT can't do the best, and sometimes what we just do better together?
Yeah. So yeah, great question. So if you remember back in my intro, I was talking about that Exit 14 slope project. So when we, you know, GDOT already plants, you know, medians and shoulders and roadsides and stuff with, you know, their fall planting and daffodils and stuff. And so, you know, we're thinking about, you know, how can we take that slope stabilization pilot project that we did and expand it? And, you know, because we don't want eroded hillsides or roadsides, right? We want these to not get mowed, right? Because it's a safety issue. And then the more they mow it, the tractor slides down the hill and it becomes more of an erosion issue. So it's like, okay, GDOT's already enrolled in the Monarch Agreement. We see that this slope stabilization works. How can we marry the two together, right? And so approached Felicity in her office. I think it took several months to get it done, but we approached them last year and we started talking about the framework of, you know, could we, you know, expand from that one slope and do 10 more slopes? So we identified slopes that, you know, we wanted these to be test pilot projects, right? And so came up with the mix. You know, it's got a lot of milkweed in it. Milkweed.
Why is milkweed important?
Because that's...
I know the answer. Yeah. I'm going to ask you.
Yeah. So milkweed's important because that's what monarchs need to help them survive in their habitat, right? And roadsides are a perfect area to plant that kind of stuff. But when we have competition from like noxious weeds, like Johnson grass and stuff like that, it makes it more difficult to get a good stand of butterfly milkweed. And then some years when we want to seed with butterfly milkweed, if there was a bad crop the year before or the previous years, that seed becomes very problematic to get, right? So anyway, so we were like, okay, we got this slope that worked. We were 3 years into it. It wasn't eroding. Everything was growing on it good. So we knew a mix that would work. And we knew what it took to stabilize these slopes. And so we found these 10 slopes. And then so we went to GDOT and to Felicity staff and we're like, okay, hey, here's 10 slopes we want to stabilize, but we want to plant it with the seed mix, you know, some of what you guys are using, what we used at 14, but let's really beef up the milkweed, right? And so in GDOT side, same thing they did at 14, the district office, they would go in and prep the area, right? Whether it needed to be sprayed with herbicide or graded. And then, you know, we at the Ray, with these 10 slopes, we went in and some of them we had to hydro seed because they were very steep slopes. And some of them that weren't as steep, we were able to use an no-till drill seeder behind a tractor. And so we did this, I think we started in February and ended in April of this year in 2026. And so now, you know, some of those we've went back and looked and they're starting to fill in and grow and everything. And you know, so it's going to take, you know, a little time for them to come in and be the way that we want them to be. But now those areas are marked with signage, as other areas that GDOT has already planted on their own with contractor support. They're marked with signage. And so now it's like those 10 slopes are now enrolled in this Monarch Conservation Agreement. So those 10 slopes are managed differently than, say, you know, the center median is on the roadside, right? Or, you know, other areas that may get mowed more frequently. And Felicity can speak to that. But these slopes, we want them to be like at a minimum, or we have maximum one time a year mow, right? And then we're using different equipment. We're not using the traditional tractor with a bush hog behind, like the one at 14. It's a skid steer with the bush hog going up and down as to prevent that erosion from reoccurring. So it's changing, you know, somewhat the way, you know, it's been done in the past, right? So, you know, that's a change there. And so now we're wanting to take it from those 10 slopes and expand it, you know, out to more slopes, because we're trying to prove out a model that works. So then GDOT has a ready packaged, you know, product here that then they can, you know, as trees are getting cut down and we're finding more slopes, it's like, hey, maybe this is, we can put this butterfly milkweed and the seed mix out there and let it do its thing and reduce the amount of maintenance on it and whatnot. So
Josh tossed that perfectly to you, because my next question was going to be about conservation mowing and why that supports the projects and why it's necessary really to make sure that these are successful. Can you sort of talk about what conservation mowing is? Because we do get, I'm told, the department does get some calls about y'all forgot this area or y'all aren't doing it right. And we are. These are different sections than your typical regularly mowed, maintenance, median. And there's a reason for that. So sort of talk us through so that because we're educational here at Head of the Curve. So what is the reason and why is that done?
Well, conservation mowing is basically when you're coming down and you're doing the regular tractor mowing on the normal cycles that are done on the rights of way, you're not mowing the entire grassed area. You're mowing the area along the edge of the pavement and in areas where you need visibility for safety. You're letting the other areas grow and giving cover, shelter, food, and everything that is needed for the pollinator insects, and then any natural milkweeds or things like that that are growing in that area then can also be there for the monarch butterflies and for all of the other insects. So it's really just you're leaving that area for later and you're cutting it back when it's not being utilized by the insects in the dormant season. It's really kind of a little bit of a simple change. And that was one of the things that when we were initially looking at signing on to the CCAA that made us think, oh, aha, this is going to be feasible, because it really is just tweaking a little bit in some areas. And then we get all of this benefit for that. We get these beautiful plants, we get the beautiful insects, and we also get a break on, you know, as Josh said, potential regulatory burden. So it was a win-win-win situation. But it's really just not cutting everything back at the same time and cutting the rest of it back when it's safe for the insects.
There is so much more going on here than really meets the eye. And that's so we want to put those questions to sort of rest, which is there is a bigger project here. There's a bigger focus. And it's not just the monarch butterfly. It's really all pollinators who are in this area.
That's right.
Yeah. And I will say it's so interesting, because when I first came on board with GDOT, I used to think, well, we can't maintain the right of way like a golf course. But then I realized and I thought, actually, that's kind of how you need to think about it, because a golf course, they don't do the same thing on the greens as they do on the fairways, as they do in the rough. They have different areas for different activities, and the vegetation has a different way that they're taking care of it to make sure it works for that. And so you can kind of think of the right-of-way the same way. The areas right up against the pavement and where you need visibility, you've got to have that short-cut grass or vegetation. In areas where you don't need it and you don't need people getting out and looking at things or you know, digging out or looking at drainage ways or what have you, you can let it grow up and be kind of like the rough of a golf course.
Rough with a purpose.
Exactly.
Rough with a greater purpose.
Exactly.
One thing I'll add into is these slopes, while we're planting them for pollinator habitats, and we're planting the milkweed so we can get into that, you know, check the box, right, for the Monarch Conservation Agreement. Another thing that's usually, that sometimes is overlooked by, you know, just people passing down the roadway is the erosion piece of it,
yes,
right? So which one's greater, right? Yeah, we need to protect pollinators, and that's very important because without them, you know, a lot of the food we eat, we don't eat, right?
Yeah.
But then, if you know, we're not making any more soil, right? So as that soil is washed away and then it ends up in our waterways, all of it leads somewhere. And then, you know, you could potentially have, from a roadside maintenance standpoint, you know, over time, we could have damage to the curbs or the shoulders or whatever. So anyway, so, you know, when we're coming up with these mixes, Felicity, his team, and then, you know, like when we're looking at these things, we want to make sure we got, you know, have grasses and different things in there that's going to have a good root structure, right? So, so that's another thing too to think about. And then limiting why it's growing high, yes, it's that pollinator habitat, but the more we can limit the equipment getting on these hillsides to perform maintenance, the better it's going to be from the erosion standpoint as well.
Yes. And it's also a safety aspect as well, because, you know, if you're trying to get large equipment on a slope, that can, you know, there's definitely safety aspects to that. And I will say that mowing is one of the most hazardous activities that is done by GDOT or by our contractors, because there's large equipment, they're right near live traffic, and the more that we can minimize those potential safety issues, the better. The other thing I'll say about erosion is, yeah, the soil washes away, but also it can clog drainage ways and cause flooding on the roadway. It can cause undermining of the pavements and things like that that are direct issues for the car. So we want to make sure that that soil is covered, that it's stabilized, and why not stabilize it with something that's going to give us so many more benefits, both from an ecological standpoint and from a standpoint of the beauty and variety of our state.
These may seem like 10 small areas. There is so much going on here.
Oh yeah, there's a lot.
We started with butterfly. We've checked, I mean, just in this short conversation, we've talked about handfuls of things that are going on that are beneficial to the earth, to the traveling public. So much going on here. What determines success for this?
I mean, from a consumer standpoint or a citizen standpoint, blooms, right? I mean, you know, that is because it's the eye of the beholder, right? So they see blooms, butterflies, pollinator counts, reports that are put out. That would be on the citizen standpoint. You know, from my standpoint, yes, that is one box it checks, but also everything else that's been mentioned, like I don't like seeing slopes that are eroded. I've mowed before several years. Mowing on a hillside like that is not safe at all. I don't care who you are, you know, how long you've been driving a tractor or whatever. So, you know, as much as we can limit that, it's great. So yeah, for me, it's like we took a slope, you know, out of having somebody wanting to mow it every time that registered right of way is mowed. We're saving the slope and the hillside. And then, you know, we also have this monarch habitat. So the blooms, I would say for the citizens, that's what would consider, you know, a success for them. And while that is a success for me, there's other things in the background that I ain't gonna say of equal importance, but, you know, they kind of all equal out at about 25% of equal importance for me.
Is success also being able to replicate this statewide?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Well, scale. Yes. So that is thing is being able to scale this, because we went from 1 to now we're at 11, and then we want to go, you know, we're talking about 30 more later today and then 100, and because there's numerous places throughout the state, So one thing we're doing at the Ray is, you know, we've, through the use of GIS, we have a solar mapping tool to help find suitable areas for solar on the right of way. So what we did, and that's in conjunction with Esri, what we did is I've always had this idea about, we have precision agriculture, right? So I'm like, could we have precision horticulture? You know, we plant seeds here. We don't know if it's going to grow here. We know we have good sunlight, but we don't know if the water drains well out of this area. How's the soil? We don't know all that. So I started thinking, I was like, I went to our GIS team. I said, could we have a tool that would help me find slopes in the state without me having to drive around and find them, or GDOT staff have to drive around and find them? And then there's these parameters I want to know about, you know, is there vegetation growing on it currently? And how is that vegetation growing? You know, how is the soil in that area? Does it drain? Is it a pond? Like when it rains, does water just sit there? Is it sandy? Is it clay? Whatever the case may be. So we have taken this tool and now we want to put it into practice. So we took this tool. We were like, show us the top 300 sites in the state of Georgia that need to be, that are slopes that need to be stabilized, and it spit it out. So now it's take that tool and put it in practice, right? And if it can prove out, if we can prove out that model, this is game changer, because we got to think more than just Georgia. Yeah, we're Georgia. We won't care about the lands in Georgia, right? But, you know, everybody could potentially benefit from a tool like this. So that's kind of where you get into that like tech AI stuff that, you know, I'm the guy like, hey, give me the shovel and the, you know, the plant and I'll put it in the ground. But, you know, we're starting to use those tools now because you have to understand that, you know, as we're all riding down the roadside, what stands out to me may not stand out to you. And I see slopes all the time. I mean, I was driving up here today and I see, I'm like, oh, we got a blank canvas now. There's been more trees taken down. But, you know, but even before trees were taken down, there were opportunities. But if you don't write down that mile marker or write down where it was, you're going to forget where it was at, right? So that's why we hope this tool can help us with that. But yes, scalability of this whole program is what is most, would be most beneficial for me, because it'd be something you could look back old 10 or 15, 20 years from now and you see it still getting done. You're like, hey, I had a hand in that, you know, at the, you know, ground level.
No pun intended.
Yeah, literally.
Felicity, for you, what a success.
Well, I think that having a beautiful solution for a persistent problem is how I would say it, because as Josh was saying, you know, when you do construction, you open up the soil, you have bare soil, you need to stabilize it. And we see that over time, given different factors, for a lot of different reasons, those areas may become destabilized. And then it's a problem. What do you do? Do you go back and do the same thing that you did initially that wasn't a long-term success? Or do you find something that has more of a long-term success that you can do there? And if you do have a solution and techniques that give you long-term success, give you that beauty, give you that variety, it's just, you know, why not?
One thing I would interject in there too, as we talk about scalability, because this is one thing I've kept in forefront of my mind because I was a former state employee, is scalability, but also cost efficient, right? Because, you know, the seeds are the most some of the most expensive piece of this puzzle. But, you know, if we're going out and like, I'm going to plant my food plot for my deer camp, my deer hunting land, I'm going to put as much fertilizer out there as possibly needed. I'm going to put as much, you know, nutrients out there as needed. Sometimes we don't have that ability on the roadside because of the cost piece of it, right? Because our seeds are already expensive. We're having to, you know, hire it out, subcontract labor, whatever the case may be. So that's one thing too, is coming up with, you know, the blueprint that it's scalable, but it's also the most economical. I'm going to say the cheapest, but the most economical that's for long-term success. And that's one thing that I always keep in the forefront of my mind as we're working through this, because again, coming from state government, I understand it's, you know, sometimes that can turn people off on wanting to do something, even though it's for a benefit. It's like, hey, we just don't have the funds or whatever the case may be. And I hear that from a lot of DOTs around the country. It's just, I try and say like, hey, you can pull from over here a little bit and let's do this project. And they're like, oh, well, no, we really can't do that. And they're like, well, we need to go get a grant. And that's one thing the RAE does as well, is try and get grants to help out with these type of projects. So you can put a pilot project out, as we did at Exit 14, see if it works. And then generally when you see it works, then it's easier for decision makers to really say, okay, let's proof this model out even further.
So. And one thing I'd like to build on what Josh was saying is, you know, the cost efficient, cost effective. One thing I like to, I think of it as is, okay, if you need a car to get from one place to another, you can find a $500 car, but if it doesn't run, you wasted $500. Maybe you can find a $5,000 car. It's more than $500, but if it runs, you got what you needed. So making something that is, if it doesn't work, you didn't save money. And that's kind of some of the things that we're seeing with some of these slopes, is whatever was done initially may have worked for a while. it didn't work long term. What can we do that's going to work long term? And then we don't have to keep going back and doing the same thing over and over again. One thing with the slope that there at exit 14 is at the same time, we did also some more of the conventional stabilization techniques that are, you know, cheaper than what was done at the test site. Those areas, it didn't take long term. The area that we did with the slightly more expensive has a thriving population of vegetation. It's interesting. It's beautiful. But it also worked. It solved the problem, and it's continuing to solve the problem. So that's the, and when you're looking at, that's one of the great benefits of working for the state and for, you know, a public agency or a public in public services. You're caring for these, for this area long term, and you have the ability to think of it long term, and you have the responsibility to look at what is this going to do right now, but how is this going to last into the future too.
You said something that I love, and so before we kind of sign off here, I want to repeat it, which is this is a beautiful solution for a persistent problem. That is such a, I think, a unique and wonderful way of looking at it. And I want to thank you both. Y'all are both incredible stewards of our land and our infrastructure. And I always love to take the opportunity to remind people that whether they believe it or not, this building does a lot more than just roads and bridges, and you two are proof of that. Always thankful for our partnership with the Ray. Always thankful for what you do, Felicity. So thank you both for being here.
Thank you so much.
So next time you are driving through Georgia or maybe even another state, I want to challenge you to look past the orange barrels and look for something different that's orange. Let that orange monarch butterfly catch your eye. Think about this conversation we had here today and what GDOT and our partners are doing to enhance conservation efforts throughout our state and on our roadways. I'm Natalie Dale with the Georgia Department of Transportation, and we look forward to chatting again on the next episode of Ahead of the Curve.